Welcome back to the program. Every day, it seems we are confronted by some kind of ethical dilemma. As life gets more complicated, as technology and speed often exceed our ability to handle it, ethical questions seem to come more frequently. Perhaps it's because we're looking for some grounding, some basic set of core values or principles that might provide a true north to help us make sense of an increasingly complex world. No one understands this better than our guest today, Randy Cohn. He has spent over a decade answering readers' questions for the New York Times Magazine Ethicist column. He is also a four-time Emmy winner for his work as a writer for The David Letterman Show. He has an MFA in music composition and was the original head writer for The Rosie O'Donnell Show, and he is currently the creator and host of the public radio program Person, Place, Thing. It is my pleasure to welcome Randy Cohn here to talk about Be Good, how to navigate the ethics of everything. Randy Cohn, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm so glad you invited me. Thanks.
It's good to have you here. So how does a comedy writer become the ethicist for the New York Times?
Yeah, the ethicist, it is a sort of fancy pants title, isn't it? And I assure you it was as unexpected to me as and the members of my family as to everyone else. It was an in-house idea, the column, originated by the editors of the Times Magazine. And they invited a bunch of people to audition for the job, mostly people with strong philosophy backgrounds, but they threw in a few writers who had written for the magazine before, and I was lucky enough to be one of those.
The audition was they put you all in a room, put the $100 on the table, and whoever didn't take it got the job.
Beautiful. That would have been so much better than what they did. You know, they gave us each three sample questions, very much like what would end up running in the column, and we were meant to provide answers, and I never thought that I would get the job. I just figured that the audition was really fun. It was very challenging. There were these little moral puzzles to solve. And I did it kind of on a lark, and I was astonished to get the call.
One of the things that's so remarkable is the way in which people reacted to the column, and that every dilemma had so many different answers, so many different points of view.
It turned out to be a particular pleasure of the job that what at first seemed daunting turned out to be fun. That I was struck that I had 650 words, and I would take up two questions in each column. So these were often questions with subtle, nuanced complications, and my job was to oversimplify professionally. So 5 minutes after the column went up, the readers would weigh in, pointing out an aspect of the question I'd neglected or they challenged my reasoning. It was wonderful. They were, for the most part, enormously courteous and civil, and it made me feel that I was running a kind of salon where we were all in this together trying to solve these moral conundrums.
Talk a little about the impact the column had on you. Did you answer questions the same way 11, 12 years into it that you would have answered in year one?
No. I'm happy to say that my thinking really did change. It would be an amazing thing if it hadn't. I should be ashamed if it hadn't changed. When I began, I thought of ethics as questions people must answer as isolated individuals in a moment of stress, and that is part of it. There are dilemmas we each face. But I more and more came to see ethics as a social transaction, as something we engage in as communities, that it became more and more apparent that most of us behave about the way our neighbors do, that there are a few of us that are saintly and a few of us that are wicked, evil villains, but most of us are in the middle of that bell curve. And so ethics seemed to be very much an expression of a community's values. And by the end, I came more and more to think that if we want people to behave well, it's incumbent on us to try to create virtuous communities, whether it's a workplace or a school or a neighborhood, that we should try to create the kind of conditions where it's possible to behave admirably, and it's amazing how often people will.
And in that sense, though, are ethics, or do they exist in a social context, or there are simply absolutes?
Yeah, there are people who make the argument that ethics are simply an expression of a transient set of values that a particular culture happens to have. That they're more anthropology than sort of fundamental moral philosophy. That's not my view. I persist in thinking that there are certain fundamental principles that apply in every time and every place. That for instance, to my way of thinking, I regard other people as entitled to the same dignity and respect that I wish for myself, and that very quickly leads you to a belief in an egalitarian society. Well, that's not what we have, you know, in America. Utopia has not arrived. In Saudi Arabia, they still forbid women to drive. But you can't defend the Saudi position by saying, oh, that's just our culture, that's how we do it here. That if you believe, as I do, in an egalitarian society, you now have a basis for arguing that they should similarly adhere to that principle.
But there are also issues that have a different social context, things like corruption, for example, in the public sphere, which is the norm in many countries, although here it certainly is not, or at least it's not intended to be.
That's so touching that you think that. Particular conduct changes from culture to culture. The context in which we operate changes from culture to culture, but I believe the principles do not. And if corruption is wrong, if bribery is wrong here, then it's always wrong. And I guess there's U.S. law now that takes this view that forbids American companies to engage in bribery, even when they're doing business in countries where bribery is endemic, and it makes it very, very hard for them to do business, that we're exporting an American law to a place that doesn't have that law, or at least doesn't have that practice. I believe this is a good policy. We see it a lot with on the internet, that it's very challenging for companies like Google that operate internationally to grapple with the question of, well, what do they do when a local government is asking them to help suppress speech that would be reprehensible here, but it's very much the practice, say, in China, where sections of the internet will be shut down, or Google, certain kinds of Google searches will be forbidden. Twitter runs into this, mm-hmm. too. Should they adhere to that government's wishes?
Is there a difference between public and private behavior, and do you have to make that distinction in looking for the ethical landmines along the way?
It seems to me no. That one argument that some ethicists make is ethics involves what we do when no one is watching.
Mm-hmm.
That those principles apply whether it's a public act or a private act. But having said that, there are certain things we do in private that we wouldn't want to do in public. Taking showers seems to be one of them. You know, but there's nothing, a desire for privacy is not a confession of wrongdoing, you know, that I wish to take my shower, not on television, doesn't mean I'm doing anything wrong. It's just that we allow certain ideas of privacy. We accord to us reasonable requests for privacy.
What were the most complex questions that you took on?
I more and more tried to take on only the complex ones, only the hard ones, because if the answers seemed too obvious, well, it was boring for me and boring for the readers. And the further along I got with the column, you know, as time went by, I plucked the low-hanging fruit, and the questions just got harder. You'd think, well, if I stick with a job, I'd get better at it, and the work life gets easier. But no, they got harder and harder.
And what areas, what arenas created the hardest questions?
I would say the most common question, the most common category of question was particularly challenging, and maybe that's why it was so often sent in. And these were duty to report questions, that you yourself have done nothing wrong, but you're aware of the wrongdoing in others, that it could be a coworker who's pilfering office supplies, or your college roommate has cheated on the midterm, or your best friend's spouse is having an affair. And they multiply complexity here because it's not just the transgression itself that you have to sort out, but you have to figure out your relationship to the person who committed it and their obligations of friendship, say. And when do you have a duty to come forward? It's a double question. And those were very hard.
And, of course, one of the key questions there is whether it's before something happens again, or after the fact when it's not going to happen again.
Really smart point. Yeah, I completely agree with you that one of the kind of guidelines I found very helpful is my belief that you have an absolute affirmative duty to come forward to prevent imminent serious harm to another person. So if a guy with a gun is coming over to my house, you must call 911. You have a much weaker obligation to call the cops if you detect some sort of tax fraud someone committed 20 years ago. Or it would be, you know, that should you try to rectify matters, should you try to even the scales of justice for something very much in the past where there's no threat of future harm, you have a much softer duty there.
And what is the duty there? Where did you come down on those questions?
Well, it's interesting that, again, I should say right away that I'm not a lawyer, and that what's legal and what's ethical certainly don't coincide all the time, that, for instance, slavery for most of American history was legal, but it was never ethical. Nonetheless, it's interesting often to see what the law says. And here in America, there is nearly no obligation for a citizen to report a crime, an ordinary citizen to report an ordinary crime, with certain exceptions that pediatricians and school teachers, and I think every jurisdiction, have a duty to report suspected cases of child abuse. Again, that's like future harm. Mm-hmm. But if you see a bank robbery, the law doesn't compel you to come forward in most places. And it also makes that distinction, and it's trying to grapple with what's a problem in ethics, too, is, well, we don't want to live in a surveillance society where our every action is being monitored by our fellow citizens, where we're constantly under scrutiny. And our whole language of this kind of thing is very pejorative. It's, you know, squealer and rat and tattletale. We don't have a lot of nice words to describe someone who reports wrongdoing. And we don't treat whistleblowers, I guess that's the nicest word we have, we don't treat them very kindly. Their fate is usually quite harsh. At the same time, we don't want wrongdoing to go unreported. And if you lived in a society where people simply avert their glance at misdeeds, well, how horribly demoralizing would that be? It means you can't count on your neighbors to look out for you at all in benign ways. So navigating your way between those conflicting demands is really hard.
The other side of that is those situations where there are no villains necessarily, but it's a kind of a clash of two goods.
Yes. A fellow wrote me because his father had purchased a kidney. His father desperately needed a kidney transplant, you know, and there's a huge waiting list. I believe it's up to 3 years now. This is a life-threatening thing. His father, and it's against American law to buy a kidney. His father went overseas and bought a kidney. Presumably, the person who sold it to him was willing to, in some sense. This was a good thing that he benefited economically, but I'm very skeptical of that. But let's say that's fine. And the father had an understandable duty to try to not die. The son loves the father. What should the son do? Should he report his father? Should he help his father get medical care later? Should he help his father in this transaction? Pretty tough stuff.
Or the husband that doesn't tell his wife about a heart attack. That's a
A good one.
Yeah.
That's a great one. That's a better one. I got that question. His desire for marital intimacy is worthy of our respect, but his desire not to worry his wife was his other consideration. What to do? And every couple has its own rules about how much people want to know, and that's a respectable desire. People are allowed to work that out for themselves. Here I thought the fellow ought to tell his wife that to sustain marital intimacy, to sustain that kind of trust, means we tell one another certainly the most important things, and that your partner is facing a potentially life-threatening health problem is something you can't not know. And one way to parse this is to ask yourself, well, okay, let's try to imagine what my wife would want. Would she want to know? And if she wants to know, you certainly should tell her, and sometimes even when she doesn't.
To what extent is power and power imbalance sometimes often at the heart of ethical dilemmas?
It shows up a lot in the injunction not to sleep with people you supervise. You know, an employer shouldn't sleep with employees, that kind of thing. There, the problem is there's so grotesque a power imbalance. If I have economic power over you, you can no longer make a truly free choice about to sleep with me or not to sleep with me, to break off relations or not. And it also becomes, and even if you do choose to do it, if you could make such a choice, it's unjust to the other employees there who feel, you now have gained some kind of power edge where you have a backdoor way to get to the boss, that we can no longer count on this as a workplace where we're judged on our merits rather than our sexual allure.
Do you sense from many of the letters over the years that people know what the right thing to do is? They're looking for reaffirmation.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, sometimes they've done very, very wicked things, and they're writing to the Times hoping it will somehow endorse car theft, you know? I like that. It accords a kind of power to the press. If the New York Times says, don't steal the car, I won't. You know, if only more people would write in before they do terrible, terrible things. Sometimes with other kinds of letters, you could tell from the way the question was phrased that the person knew what they should do. They knew they shouldn't shoot the dog, even though it was a really wicked dog and it pees on the couch and it chews up their shoes. But they somehow sensed, I shouldn't shoot the dog. They didn't want me to tell them that. What they wanted me to tell them was why. Well, why can't I shoot this horrible, horrible creature? My task was to make a reasoned, logical, coherent case for why they should do what you could tell they already knew they should do. It was a relief that so often turned out to be the case, too, that I don't write from the position of authority. It made me very squeamish to tell people what to do. But the notion of working out why you should do a thing, that seemed more comfortable for me.
You didn't have a lot of CEOs writing in.
Well, I think this is this line what in that Preston Sturges movie, Palm Beach Story. Is it Joel McRae who says, it's a great tragedy of life that the people most in need of a beating up are always enormous? it always seemed, I was so impressed with the moral seriousness of the people who wrote to the column and of the people who wrote in to point out how wrong I got it, that they lived in a moral universe. They saw the ordinary transactions of daily life as involving matters of right and wrong and worthy of analysis. They wanted to do the right thing. The people who didn't write in, I'm not so sure of. And I never got a letter from a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, even one facing indictment. You know, I never heard from a member of the Senate or the House. This is who I most like to give advice to. They never sought my advice.
Bernie Madoff never wrote in.
Never wrote in. You know, his whole life could have been different if only he'd written me. And yet somehow I feel he might have known he was doing the wrong thing.
How did it impact your personal decisions that you would make in your life about situations where there was an ethical call to be made?
Hardly at all, I confess with some shame, that writing the column never required me to be a particularly virtuous person going in. I wasn't hired to be a role model for the kids, you know. The same way sports writers are so seldom able to hit the jump shot from
right.
beyond 15 feet, you know, I was not supposed to be a morally heroic figure. And even after 12 years of writing the column, I don't think I behaved significantly better. I do think I became more aware of the imperfections of my own choices, more aware of falling short. It was deeply demoralizing. My ability to rationalize my misconduct got weaker and weaker from writing the column. But I suppose that's the fate of all adults. You know, to grow old is to grow remorseful, or at least any adult who has some self-awareness and the courage to activate that self-awareness. You've had a chance. Life has given you many opportunities to do things you've regretted or things that you think you wish you'd done better. And now you know what they are. And my job made that particularly potent.
To what extent do you think the technology and the speed at which things move today has an impact on the ethical decisions people make? Because many times they have less time to think about it. It has to be more intuitive.
Well, it's certainly the case when they call me dirty names in email. They hit send a little too quickly. I'm not so sure, from what I saw anyway, that it was a matter of speed as much as new technologies put people in unfamiliar situations where the right action wasn't always so apparent. And that's by far the biggest change I saw in the kind of questions people asked over those 12 years. They very much derive from new technology, especially the Internet. And the biggest one was questions about privacy that we spoke about a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm thinking of Google and Facebook, you know, really changed our notion of what do we mean by privacy? What do people have a right to expect? How much of our lives should be just exposed to other people? And I remember the early days of the column, a woman was set up on a blind date, and she wanted to know if it was okay to Google the guy. And she really quite reasonably wondered, well, am I intruding? Is this sort of akin to hiring a private detective? You know, it's am I just prying into this guy's life? And now it seems so quaint. I was so naive, because now the idea that she wouldn't do that seems like, well, she's just rash. She's just imprudent. What a hothead, you know. How can she be so reckless? I think our view about that has really changed, and that becomes a routine transaction now to Google the person. And quite right, you're right. Delving into what we now regard as entirely public information, if not always reliable.
What about the white lies and social lies that we tell as kind of a social lubricant?
I'm for them. That social scientists have more and more pointed out that how often we lie, and that since we're social creatures, we live in groups, we're not isolated individuals out on the prairie, there are certain kinds of lies that are indeed social lubricants. If we said everything we were thinking out loud, we couldn't face one another. You know, we'd be at each other's throats. So the interesting question then for adults isn't like, should you lie? We raise our children to be honest. We tell them, no, no, you should never tell a lie. But the question isn't, should we tell lies? Well, yeah, there are lots of times a lie is absolutely the right thing to do. It's when we should tell a lie and what kind of lies are okay and what kind of lies are not okay. And to make it even more complicated, even a benign lie, even a lie that's absolutely called for, extracts a social cost. I'm Dr. Johnson, the great 18th century moralist, my kind of moral hero throughout the time writing the column, and just in general, he made this neat comparison that comparing a lie to the passing of counterfeit money, and just the way counterfeit money is destructive beyond any immediate transaction because it undermines our trust in the currency as a whole. Well, Johnson pointed out that every lie undermines our ability to trust one another in future, and that's very unfortunate. And yet, there are certainly times when a lie is not only permitted but required. And the easy example is, okay, it's 1850, and you're working on the Underground Railroad. You have a house full of runaway slaves. The slave catcher knocks on the door and says, any slaves? Well, you have to lie then. So once you accept that, well, then you have to ask yourself, when are other lies acceptable? Not if we should ever lie, but when we should lie. And that's very, very, that's tough stuff for adults.
I think we trust each other more or less than when you started writing this column 12 years ago.
I don't think I've seen that kind of change. And not so surprisingly, that cultures change very, very slowly. And you wouldn't expect to see a real shift in values over just 12 years. But that kind of thing wasn't reflected in the questions I got. Although apparently we see it in social scientists again. The various surveys that suggest trust has diminished in many of our institutions. There's, I guess, trust for the House of Representatives is at an all-time low. Isn't it down to, like, practically single digits?
Yes.
Trust in just what's called generally the media has declined in the last dozen years. Although I thought that's an odd way to ask the question, since I would wonder, well, what media? You know, that my feelings about the New York Times are different than my feelings about Fox News. I don't think I'm alone in that.
What was the most troubling question that you ever got, the one that really almost stumped you?
I would be stumped routinely, at least in that the answer to a question put to me was not obvious. It would sit on my desk for months. So I tried to work my way through it and discuss it with other people. The hard stuff, and I can remember a very early one that was confounding. And a woman is traveling on business, and in the hotel bar, she sees her best friend's spouse in the arms of another. Should she tell her friend? It's the kind of duty to report question we were speaking mm-hmm. about earlier, and she got at the issue so beautifully. She thought, if I don't tell my friend, I feel I'm conspiring to deceive her, and that's a terrible thing to do. If I do tell her, well, I may be forcing her to confront something that she kind of half knows but is willing to live with, but if she officially knows it, it could be destructive to her marriage in a way that she doesn't want. What to do? And in my view, there was no right answer. Whatever you do in a situation like this is wrong. But I came to see it more and more as a question not about sexual morality. Your duty here wasn't to be the sort of infidelity police, but a question about the duties of friendship, which are very, very real. Mm-hmm. And my conclusion was that you must serve your friend here, that whatever she wants, that's what you must do. And remember, we're talking about a close friend. So you might have some inkling into her desire. Some people really want to know, and some people really don't. And so if your friend wants to know, you must tell her, even though it will imperil your friendship. And if she doesn't want to know, you have to keep this to yourself, even though it means carrying around this horrible, horrible burden. The tricky thing is, what if you're not sure? And even among close friends, sometimes people just don't know what their friend wants. And it's way too late in the game to go, well, hypothetically, you know. So for me, the default position was silence, that we mess around in other people's marriages to our peril, and if you're not sure your friend wants to know, well, keep it to yourself. A somewhat unsatisfying position for me, anyway. The utopian solution involved a reform in the driver's license laws. But here in New York, I'm not sure if it's the same in California, here in New York we check on our driver's license whether we're willing to be an organ donor after mm-hmm. death. And there should be something like that for infidelity, that you can check, I want to know or I don't want to know. And then when your friend leaves the room, you go through her wallet.
A tie goes to the silence.
For me, the tie goes to the silence, yes, until we get this utopian reform.
Randy Cohn, his new book is Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. Randy, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
I enjoy talking to you.
Thank you.